Hi, this is Scott. If you're a fan of the ancient world, please help us get the word out. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and rate the series on iTunes. Thanks again for listening. It's an interesting time to try to imagine, which is largely what we all have to do, because the early 11th century BC may have had plenty of action, but it had very few written sources. The toughest mental framework to break is any kind of stark division between the Bronze and Iron Ages. By a few more centuries down the road, it's safe to talk of a variety pack of bite-sized mini-kingdoms with a predilection for iron weapons and alphabetic scripts. But both these trends began long before the Bronze Age collapse and would continue to develop all throughout the Iron Age. We already talked about coastal Ugarit, which had developed its own alphabetic script long before its destruction by the Sea Peoples. And, as it happened, among the early innovators in the use of iron were the Hittites of Anatolia. To set the stage, way back in the Middle Bronze Age, the Assyrians had set up a network of trading colonies in Anatolia, with their hub at the city of Kanesh. For those familiar with the Neo-Assyrians, or even the Middle Assyrians of the Late Bronze Age, it's hard to imagine a time when they were a people more famous for trade than for war. When the city of Kanesh was violently destroyed around 1700 BC, the Assyrians pulled out of the region. One of the impacts of this withdrawal was that it left the Hittites without a convenient source of copper, and especially tin, to make tin bronze. Which is probably a major reason why two of their kings, Hattusili I and his grandson, Mursili I, spent part of the next century trying to dominate the Syrian kingdom of Yom Kod, to gain control of important metal trade routes. But to their credit, the Hittites didn't put all their eggs into that single bronze basket. Because at the same time, records reflect an increased focus by Hittite metalsmiths on working domestic iron. Historian J. Sigalova lays out the following timeline, which begins shortly after the fall of Kanesh. In Hittite sources of the 17th and 16th centuries BC, iron still appears as an extraordinary metal, restricted to the production of royal insignia and weapons such as lances and scepters. In the 15th and 14th centuries BC, the variety of iron objects grew, and now included ceremonial objects distributed to cult functionaries. In the 13th century, written attestations for iron objects rise considerably, and the variety broadens to include large numbers of knives, daggers, swords, and spearheads. Proof of the widespread use of iron in this period is also corroborated by the fact that some Hittite communities provided their taxes in iron. Historian Violetta Cordani notes that contemporary Anatolia had a wealth of iron deposits. She also relates that during the 13th century, high-quality iron was being produced in Anatolia and represented, for the Assyrian kings, a much-wanted product. She goes on to summarize that it seems, therefore, that the transition from bronze to iron started during the Hittite period, and the crisis at the end of the 13th century BC only accelerated a process that was already underway. Or, put another way, Bronze Age Hittite metalworkers helped prime the pump for the coming Near Eastern Iron Age. 11th century BC Syria was a time and place very much in flux. I picture it like an interstellar nebula, a swirling mix of ancient cultures and newly arrived or emergent peoples who'd collide with each other and coalesce into something a bit more defined. At the same time, the region was hardly a vacuum, and the remnants of the major Bronze Age powers exerted a major pull. Among these was a kingdom that, without the slightest hint of irony or deception, very much considered itself to be the continuation of the Bronze Age Hittite Empire. And, as you may have guessed, it was centered on the city of Carchemish. In the early 11th century BC, the great king of Hatti may have been a man named Tutelaya. According to historian Trevor Bryce, the evidence for Tutelaya's existence is a broken stele with small fragments of an inscription, which, for this particular time and place, is the equivalent of an epic poem. In the inscription, Tutelaya is described as great king and hero, the same titles used by his likely predecessors who'd also ruled from Carchemish. Provided he was their descendant, this Tutelaya could trace his line, not to mention his kingdom's existence, all the way back to Supaluliuma I. A few miles north along the Euphrates was the independent kingdom of Malatya. Its contemporary ruler, who took the title of Potent King, was named Pugnus Mili III. Since the first Pugnus Mili of Malatya had been a son of Kuzi Teshub, the current king may have belonged to the same line, a distant cousin of Tutelaya of Carchemish. They may have operated independently, may have been allies, or may have at least had a basic working relationship. Either way, if the titles used are any guide, Tutelaya clearly remained the senior partner. The lands he ruled were the remaining rump of the Hittite state, particularly the portions located in northern Syria. And the fact that this region became known as Hatti isn't quite as odd as it sounds. From shortly after Supaluliuma's conquest, the region had been flooded with officials, soldiers, priests, and subjects, all loyal to the Hittite Empire. Supaluliuma's son, Mursili II, had also introduced the novel practice of deporting rebellious Luwian speakers from the Hittite periphery to other frontier regions, including Syria. And to that, you can add the refugees who'd fled Anatolia in the wake of the Bronze Age collapse. All this adds up to a significant Hittite presence. We don't have a great feel for demographics. Syria was always a melting pot, and Luwian speakers remained a small minority. But they did have an outsized influence, mainly because even after the Bronze Age collapse, the Hittites retained the fractured bones of a local imperial network. Records also reflect that all throughout the post-collapse era, the kings of Carchemish took a lead role in the slow, painstaking process of Syrian recovery. Officials were needed to oversee projects, prioritize resources, enforce laws, resolve disputes, and restore some sense of stability. If only so taxes could start flowing again. And interestingly, many officials may have been drawn from the extended Hittite royal family. Way back in the 13th century BC, Tutelaya IV had famously remarked that the land of Hatti is full of the royal line. In Hatti, the descendants of Supaluliuma, the descendants of Muwatalli, the descendants of Hattusili are numerous. Even before the fall of Hatti, many of these royals, both high and low, had taken up posts in Syria. The collapse and abandonment of Hattusis likely led to another influx. And honestly, if you're the king of Carchemish, all these second cousins twice removed were likely a bit of a headache. Because unless you managed to keep them occupied, they were just a big fat drain on the treasury. Deploying them to support the Syrian recovery may have seemed like a reasonable fix. We know what emerged around a century later, a clutch of minor Syrian kingdoms whose rulers adopted Hittite royal names, used elements of Hittite royal architecture, and wrote royal inscriptions using the same Luwian hieroglyphs used by the kings of Hatti. Just to mention it, there was one change. The Hittite language, written using a cuneiform script adopted from the Assyrians, was now well and truly dead. There's zero evidence of it being used after the Bronze Age collapse. But Luwian hieroglyphs had already been used in parallel for quite some time, and that script was still going strong. Anyway, just to connect the dots, there's a reasonable chance that these later Neo-Hittite kingdoms, nucleated around local officials, including minor royals, installed by the kings of Carchemish. Given their regional leadership role, their ongoing use of the title Great King seems pretty justified. In fact, I'm going to go one further and refer to the king we introduced earlier as King Tudhaliya V. Placing him in the early 11th century BC may have made him the son or grandson of Eni Teshub, the king who'd been forced to hand over tribute to Tiglath-Pileser I. Considering that, and the ongoing regional situation, Eni Teshub may have exhorted his heirs to keep one good eye on Assyria. When Tiglath-Pileser died in 1076 BC, he left behind three sons. The first to succeed him was Asharid-apal-Ekr, but he only managed to last 2 years before being succeeded by his younger brother, Ashur-bel-kala, whom I briefly introduced last episode. Most of what we know, or think we know, about the reign of Ashur-bel-kala derived from the images and texts contained on an object known as the Broken Obelisk. Provided he's the king it describes, and the jury's still deliberating, Ashur-bel-kala began his reign in a similar mode to his father, campaigning up north against the Mushki and Nairi. Around this time, Ashur-bel-kala also received a visit from the king of Babylon, Marduk-Shapik-Zeri, who was looking to forge an anti-Aramean alliance. The summit met with some success, and the king recorded that he established friendly relations with Ashur-bel-kala before returning to Babylon. Unfortunately, the alliance lasted about as long as most of the previous attempts. Around 5 years later, when Marduk-Shapik-Zeri died, a governor of the region of Dur-Kurigalzu named Kadash-Manburiash either declared independence or staked a claim to the Babylonian throne. Either way, Ashur-bel-kala invaded Babylonia, deposed him, and installed an Assyrian vassal king named Adad-apla-Edina. As the Klingons say, only a fool fights in a burning house, and all these intrigues did absolutely nothing to help with regional defense. As historian George Rue notes, this is the same time that the Aramaeans were penetrating deeper and deeper into Mesopotamia, settling as they advanced and forming a network of kingdoms, large or small, which enclosed Assur and Babylon in an ever-narrowing circle. Unfortunately, the recently installed Babylonian king was not really up to the task. An inscription records that during the reign of Adad-apla-Edina, king of Babylon, hostile Aramaeans and Sutians sacked the land of the Sumerians and the Akkadians, leveled all temples, and made off with the goods and the property of Enlil. Adad-apla-Edina did take some measures, like repairing the walls of his capital of Babylon, but it was basically closing the barn door after the horses had left. In a later Babylonian epic poem, the beginning of the end of the glories of Babylon was pegged to the new king's reign. The main reason I'm talking about all this, other than I find it interesting, is that it does tie back to Carchemish. And the connective tissue is the Aramaeans. In Syria, the Aramaeans were flooding into former Mitanni territories along the Khabur River Valley and were also crossing the Euphrates. And similar to Mesopotamia, wherever they settled, they began to form small kingdoms. City-states is probably more accurate, since the kingdoms were based on a single city that served as a political capital. But still, in aggregate, they represented a growing threat to established Hittite power. There's no direct evidence of the city of Carchemish falling to Aramaean attack. Which kind of makes sense, since disorganized forces, no matter how large or intimidating, often have difficulty capturing fortified cities. As long as the crops could be gathered and the people collected inside the walls, there was a decent chance of holding out. Especially for a city like Carchemish, with access to the Euphrates. No, the real threat was an organized army. Like, oh, say, the Assyrian army. And the kings of Carchemish may have viewed the Aramaeans as a useful wall of flesh and metal to prevent Assyrian attack. Or at least they did as long as that buffer lasted. According to the Broken Obelisk, at some point Ashurbelkala campaigned in the Khabur River Valley. After he smote the Aramaeans, the inscription records that he crossed the Euphrates in rafts made of inflated goatskins and plundered the city of Carchemish in the land of Hatti. And here's where I totally have to own up, because I said previously that Tiglath-Pileser's aggressive drive-by was the last Assyrian visit to the region for centuries. In my defense, this particular incident isn't very well known, and I only learned about it later. But anyway, 100% mea culpa. The reason for Ashurbelkala's attack probably isn't too much of a mystery. Carchemish was the region's largest surviving city, and it had also had decades to replenish the treasury so famously plundered by his father. I know I've said it before, but trust me, this is the very last flourish of Assyrian meddling in the West before they became completely, fully, and totally preoccupied with defending the Assyrian homeland. If you read the rest of the Broken Obelisk, it's basically just a list of places and occasions where Ashurbelkala fought the Aramaeans, until he eventually died. And was succeeded by his son, Ereba-Adad II. At the same time, his brother, another son of Tiglath-Pileser named Shamshi-Adad, fled to Babylonia, where he was hosted in the court of King Adad-apla-Edina, until he returned to Assyria, deposed his nephew, and took power as King Shamshi-Adad IV. But sticking with Carchemish, the aftermath of the Assyrian attack saw one significant change. Because the last Hittite kings to use the titles Great King and Hero date from around this time. There was Tutelaya V, whom we mentioned earlier. There was also a possible successor named Ekpazeti, where X means, I'm sorry, but I just cannot make that character out, and another named Urartahunze. Any of the three of them may have been king during Ashurbelkala's raid. But the more important thing is this. In the decades after the Assyrian attack, a new dynasty came to power in Carchemish. Toward the end of his reign, the last great king, Urartahunze, was in conflict with a figure named Suhi. Bryce notes that in the Temple of the Storm God in Carchemish, an inscribed stele commemorates a military victory by Urartahunze over an army from another land. More cryptically, the inscription was composed by a figure who identifies himself as a priest of the goddess Kubaba and the son of a ruler called Suhi, which implies that his father, Suhi, either succeeded or deposed Ur-Tarhunza to found a new Hittite dynasty. Who was Suhi? In terms of his origins, there's one linguistic clue. We mentioned earlier the Sutean nomads of the Middle Euphrates, who often joined the Aramaeans in plundering contemporary Babylon. The Sutians, or Sutu, lived in the area southeast of Mari, an area that was alternately known as Suhum, Suhu, or Suhi. So it's possible that the figure called Suhi either hailed from this region or had a Sutian background. Whatever his origins, the Suhi of our story was now based in northern Syria. Bryce suggests that he may have been a local ruler within the Carchemish kingdom, possibly one of the great king's senior officials who eventually replaced him on the throne. We don't know how the transition occurred, but since we're talking about a dynasty that had endured for centuries, something unusual must have happened. Given the proximate timing, it makes me wonder whether Ashurbelkala's assault may have weakened the dynasty or the city's defenses enough to enable its overthrow. On taking the throne, Suhi quickly dispensed with any Hittite imperial pretensions and adopted the straightforward title Ruler of Carchemish. None of his dynasty, or any that followed, would ever reclaim the Bronze Age title of Great King. As Bryce notes, this probably reflected political reality. The kingdom had now become but one of a number of small states in the region, each of which had its own ruler, and none of which could claim sovereignty over the others. Whatever the circumstances, the new Suhi dynasty would rule Carchemish for most of the following century. Next episode, we'll get to know Suhi's neighborhood a little bit better, and touch on what we know of the kingdoms, peoples, and figures that define the contemporary scene. And we'll check in on another Bronze Age power, as an increasingly divided, threatened, and isolated Egypt is forced to abandon its remaining outposts along the Levantine coast.